when we look at the judges as a whole, information about them is spread over three Old Testament books. Mainly the book of Judges, which is the assignment for today, but also the book of Ruth occurs in the days of the judges and also in the early chapters of 1 Samuel. God did not institute the period of the judges so that judges, in contrast to kings, might rule. The judges were emergency people. They were called only as they were needed. They were introduced in the role of rescuers after the people had sinned and faced oppression because of their sin. But the judges were not ends in themselves. They were called only because they became necessary. I think that's an important point. God wanted his chosen people to be ruled by a theocratic form of government, with God as the supreme ruler. It's not a democracy in which people rule. It's not a monarchy in which an earthly king rules. Theocracy is the highest form of government available, highest form possible. Yeah, over here, well, we raised Saul and David, but even after the monarchy started, even if all the kings had been good kings, that still would not have been the highest form of government. It would not have been what God wanted most for Israel. Theocracy knows no earthly king at all. No ministers of state, no court, no parliament, no Congress, none of that, because none of that is needed if God is the center of interest and the focal point of the people's lives. You don't need any of this human stuff. In the theocratic form of government, God planned one class of earthly personnel, and that was the priesthood. The priests were God-related personnel, and therefore they would not detract if they did their job well. They wouldn't detract from the idea of a theocracy. The designation of priests as the one group in authority would have contributed to the idea that the center of reference was solely in God. But the law had been given by God, and that made any earthly legislation unnecessary. All that was necessary, two things were necessary. One was for the priest to teach the law, and then the people to obey the law. Those two things were necessary. And that was the big job of the priest, to teach the law, and the people were to obey it. God wanted his people to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, Exodus 19:6. This was the idea from the beginning. The people would have enjoyed the finest blessings under this best form of ruling. Under the theocracy, they didn't need to pay any taxes to support a civil government. There were elders who dealt with matrimonial disputes, family problems, these types of local issues, and the elders probably supported themselves. At least we don't find any financial provision made for them in the law. The theocracy would have been a great pleasure for the people and would have made them a great advertisement for God in the world. People of other nations would have been attracted to follow the God who could so prosper a people. And don't forget that this land was traveled through all the time. It was the most strategically located land on the face of the earth. That narrow band of land between the Arabian Desert and the Mediterranean Sea had to be passed through by anybody coming up out of Egypt, by anybody going down to Egypt on a trade route. It had tremendous access by the sea, ports on the Mediterranean, port down on the Red Sea. So it was just the most beautiful, perfect little postage stamp of a country geographically located that you could possibly imagine. God had this all thought out. And the only problem was the sinfulness of the people. That's why the change came. The period of theocracy had to continue long enough to give ample opportunity for it to work, so that in the mind of man it could be seen that it was given ample opportunity to work. But the people refused to let this highest form of government work. So God then gave them a second best form of government. Sin abounded, and because it did, there arose a need for some type of supervision, human supervision, because there was such radical disobedience. And as God had set it up under the theocracy, there was no real enforcement organization that existed to control people who were this out of control. That point is well made in the last five chapters of the book of Judges. Those two stories there, we'll talk about those in a minute, Lord willing. We've got two stories covering the last five chapters of the book of Judges, beginning in chapter 17. And it shows how things went when people went further and further into sin. But God wanted people to obey voluntarily. As long as there was just a little disobedience, the people themselves could do what needed to be done about it. But the highest form of government could not have a provision for enforcing widespread obedience and still be the highest form. God wanted voluntary obedience. When there was no group for policing the people, and the people as a whole would not obey voluntarily, then disobedience became a habitual lifestyle of the people year in and year out. And the warnings of Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 through 68, showed what would happen without the necessary obedience. God's reply to Samuel in 1 Samuel 8, when the people were asking for a king, was that the people had been rejecting him since the day he brought them out of Egypt. It wasn't just then. It had come to a head then in 1 Samuel 8. It wasn't just then. They'd been rejecting him on a regular basis since they came out of Egypt. So God's patience gave ample time for the theocracy to work, if it could work, among these people. The foreign oppressions were used as means of discipline. Yeah, no? Oh, sure. Yeah, they were, in most cases, they were thorough readers of the Old Testament. James Madison just read about every country that ever existed and how their governments were, how they worked. These were smart people, and they put together very, very carefully, based on their knowledge of history and the nature of man. They put together very carefully the checks and balances of government, and they did create a human government that could have worked very, very well. But again, it's all the stumbling block is always man going off into sin. Yeah, Ellen? In Genesis? Did I get one in Genesis? I don't remember mentioning one. Well, it may be my mistake, but I don't remember. Just none of us. Maybe I'll think of something on that later. Yeah, Jefferson said that government governs best which governs least. And that's right along with Tom's question there. It's, I think, very, very parallel. Of course, our founding fathers were uninspired men, and the inspired God is the one who brought about this. I don't want to paint the picture that America was a second Israel or anything like that. So you have to stop the parallel someplace. But there is a parallel there. When it didn't, when the foreign oppressions against the people didn't ultimately work, then this highest form of rule possible was withdrawn, because sin called for extra supervision at the human level. The job of the judges was to curtail sin, primarily, and to deliver from foreign oppression. The judge form of government was significantly less removed from the idea of theocracy than monarchy was. It was as little removed from theocracy as any earthly type of rule could be, because a judgeship could be brought to an end very quickly, very easily. The people had this least possible form of government with the theocracy. They had it to a degree with the judgeship as well. Remember, the judgeship was not an official form of rule. The judge was not elected or humanly appointed as an official, and it was not a continuous form. There were extensive gaps of time permitted between judgeships, especially in the early years. The idea of judgeship did not call for continuity. Judges were raised up only as needed, and it didn't involve any other governmental personnel as a bureaucracy that was just in place for over all time and that you couldn't get them out no matter how you tried. There was nobody, no government personnel to whom the judge was obligated in any kind of way. He didn't have to give resignation notice to anybody because there was nobody to give it to. The judge did not have a court. He didn't have official advisors. He didn't have heads of departments. All these things that we're used to in human government. God granted the judge the necessary ability for his leadership and to go out and do his job. And after he had brought about a military victory, for example, the people continued looking to that person who had just led in the military victory. This is the most natural thing in the world, to have confidence engendered in that military leader on the part of the people. That's how General Eisenhower became president after the Second World War. It's possible that the minor judges were already men of influence before they were judges. At least four of them had very large families and or rather extensive possessions. There is a marked increase, and you can see this on those charts, a marked increase in the number of judgeships during the closing years of the judges' period. We said that the entire time took apparently about 340 years. The first oppressions and peace period add up to about 271 years. That's most of the period of time. The minor judge Shamgar was in that time as well, for a total of five judges in the first 271 years. There's only 69 years left In that last 69 years, we find four major judges, Jephthah, Samson, Eli, and Samuel, and five minor judges, Kolah, Jair, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. So in 271 years, five judges ruled. In 69 years, nine judges ruled. And further, I'll go one step further with you. This degree of concentration increased even during those last 69 years. During the closing 30 years, seven judges ruled. Only Tola and Jair are eliminated from the nine. What do we make of this? What I make of it is that there was a marked increase in sin, therefore a corresponding increase in judgments, and therefore more judgeships. The more judgeships were seen necessary to keep sin under control, the further removed became the possibility of any theocratic reinstatement. God was recognizing the growing need for monarchy, and finally, when it came to a head in 1 Samuel 8, God himself told Samuel, go ahead and let him have a king. This is what he was going to deal with man as man was, because how else can you deal with man? We might ask, why is the biblical coverage of the period of the judges so brief? After all, we only have about 35 chapters maximum here. Even if you go here through the first 10 chapters of 1 Samuel before Saul really gets going as a king, 35 chapters maximum. I think the reason we don't have more about it is because there was little that was meaningful to report during the years of the judges. Sin was rampant. The great theme of the Bible is redemption. That's what the Bible is really about. But there was little that was happening during the time of the judges that was redemptively significant, hence the brief coverage of a 340-year period of time. God gave revelation periodically, anyway, rather than giving it just an irregular chronological pattern. He would give it periodically, a lot, and then very little for a long time. He gave man the opportunity to show his response to new revelation before giving more revelation. And God had just preceded the time of the judges with one of his most concentrated times of revelation through Moses. We've got a lot from the time of Moses in the Bible. The period of the judges was a time of waiting to see how man would react to what he had already been given. And that's why the word of the Lord was rare in those days. That's a direct quote from 1 Samuel 3:1. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Prophets did exist, but not in the number and not with the variety of message that was true of the monarchy. During the monarchy, there were quite a number of prophets for one main reason. The prophets were set as a counterbalance against the kings. When you didn't have kings, you didn't need as many prophets. But once the kings were there, there was so much power invested in the kingship that you needed prophets to offset that. And this is why every Saul had his Samuel to say, thou hast done foolishly. Every David had his Nathan to say, thou art the man. Every Ahab had his Elijah. Every Ahaz had his Isaiah. There was too much power in the kingship to let it go unchecked. The nation could not have continued as long as it did during the monarchy without the prophets. And of course, more prophets meant more revelation, and the Bible got bigger. The judges period, by the way, wasn't known for its poets either, although Deborah does write a poem that's the fifth chapter of the book of Judges. But the time of David and Solomon was the golden era of Hebrew poetry. As the Old Testament time moved past, there was an increasing amount of revelation as the time of Christ approached, but here in the Judges we're relatively early. We might ask why Ruth's story is recorded separately from the book of Judges. Interestingly, Josephus doesn't count Ruth as a separate book. He seems to regard Ruth as an appendix to the book of Judges. But the nature of the story of Ruth is a contrast with the stories in the book of Judges. The theme of the book of Judges is the sinfulness of Israel. Ruth's story is not in keeping with that theme. The Judges period was not all bad, and God apparently wanted the complete picture seen, hence the book of Ruth is given to us. You might ask, why are the stories of Eli and Samuel recorded separately from the book of Judges? Eli and Samuel were important to Israel in functions other than just their judgeships. Eli was a high priest in the Ithamar line. Samuel was as much a prophet as a judge. And both of them may have been better known in their day, and surely are better known today, in these other areas. Both of them were different in this respect from the other judges. The main significance of Eli and Samuel, just in case I don't get to talk about them with you today, I'll just say this word about them now. The main significance of Eli and Samuel lay in relation to the beginning of the monarch rather than the ending of the judges period. Samuel was God's special instrument to keep the Israelite nation from utter and complete collapse prior to the inauguration of the monarchy. Things really got bad there for a while, and if Samuel had not stood in the gap, I think things could have been much different. The purpose of the book of Judges is to give a record of Israel's sinfulness, not to give a history of the time, but to stress the sinfulness of Israel. Because Israel's beginning in Canaan had held such great promise for blessings which were not realized, and God wanted everybody to know why these blessings were not realized. The people were living in a state of defection. They knew better. God had told them how to act. We have the story of the wandering Levite in chapter 17, who was opportunistic and looking for places of service. He was in rebellion to the regulation of God in not living where he was assigned. The Levites were assigned where to live. This guy is out wandering the country. He's come up from Bethlehem, which wasn't even one of the 48 Levitical cities in the first place, and he's looking for some place to be the religion guy, the preacher, whatever you want to call it. He's looking for a place to get hired to do this kind of work. He was in rebellion against God, and his story is included, I believe, to show one more way that the Israelites were sinning. You might want to look at that outline of the book of Judges on that first sheet just for a moment. There's only three main sections there. We won't spend long with it. There's three main sections there. That first division shows one particular sin, the failure to occupy the land. They didn't occupy it like they were supposed to. This is why Israel lived primarily in the hill country, because they didn't take the lower country. They were wrong in being confined to the hill country because God told them to take the whole country. So this is an immediate clue under point number one. It's an immediate clue to the stress that is made throughout the book. In the second division, Roman numeral number two, it shows the result of the initial sin in not clearing the land. This centers in six cycles of oppression and deliverance. And the third division illustrates the sins themselves. We have two main stories that illustrate sin in its many forms. And undoubtedly, any number of other stories could have been added. Interestingly, these two main stories that are mentioned here, Micah and the move of the Danites and the atrocity at Gibeah and the Civil War, those two stories occurred relatively early in the era of the Judges. They come at the end of the book of Judges, and it's easy to assume that they were very late and show how bad things got. But really, they were rather early, and probably things got even a lot worse than that, if you can imagine. But these two main stories illustrate sin in its many forms. Undoubtedly, a lot of other stories could have been added. Both of these occurred relatively early. They appear at the end, leaving the reader with the impression that there was a change needed. Government in some other form was needed. The fact that they occurred early allows us to assume that they do not indicate sin in the worst way that it became. Sin increased in kind and degree as the years passed. So, there's a lot of variation in the stories of the judges. When we have just three verses about a judge, that probably means that there wasn't too much from that man's life that God thought we could learn something from. When you have 100 verses about a judge, as in the case of Gideon, that seems to indicate that God thought there was quite a bit we could learn from that. There's so much variation in these stories. Two of the judges worked alone, pretty much. Ehud did have some helpers, but worked primarily alone. Samson worked almost entirely alone. The first three stories of delivering judges included almost nothing about the personal lives of the judges. The last three have a lot of personal information told about them. We know that Gideon and Samson engaged in serious sin. This is not said of the others. Jephthah tried to negotiate a settlement, peaceful settlement, with the Ammonites by peaceful means, and he alone is said to have made an attempt like that. So there's a lot of variety in this book. The beginning of the Judges period was one of the most exciting, one of the most potentially productive times. Israel was to be a model nation, a new nation in its own land, like a head nation. Never in all history was there to be another moment like this. God wanted at least one nation in the world that would give due allegiance to him. In Abraham's day, God had told Abraham that the iniquity of the Ammonites is not yet full. Genesis chapter 15. Maybe that's the scripture. Genesis chapter 15. The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. They were already very sinful, the Ammonites, standing for the Canaanites in general, I think. But the Amorites. But God permitted the residents of Canaan to develop to a certain degree of sinfulness before he told his people to clear the land of it. They've had hundreds of years now to get it right. The important thing here with regard to the people in the land when the children of Israel got there is that they were farmers. And the people of Israel, who had been living on free manna that they picked up off the ground for 40 years wandering in the wilderness, may not have remembered much about how to farm. I don't know, but it makes sense to me. So they may have felt like they needed help to learn how to farm in this land. They may have felt they needed instruction from the people who've been doing it for a while, and that may have helped to open the door to pagan religious involvement, because paganism, religious paganism, was involved in every aspect of farming on the part of the Canaanites. Oh, let's see here. By the time of David, there were so many priests that 24 divisions had to be made. Each had its scheduled time at the tabernacle for about a week or so at a time. That means if there were 24 divisions, the priest would serve about 2 weeks a year at the tabernacle itself. There was no temple yet in David's day, of course. 2 weeks a year at the tabernacle. What do they do with the other 50 weeks or so out of the year? They're in these 48 cities that they live throughout the land, and the main job of the priest was to teach the law in every kind of way that they could legitimately do this. We don't know how many divisions there were in the times before David, but it's similar. It's probable, or at least possible, that a similar division had already been made by the time of the Judges period, because there would have been a lot of priests by this time. So Levi was scattered in Israel. Remember Genesis 49, this prediction was made. And Levi was scattered in Israel. The priests and the Levites lived in 48 cities throughout the other tribes. Priests and Levites were able to live at home in their assigned cities for most of the year, about 50 weeks a year. And still, they were not required to work to support themselves. They were supported by the gifts of the people. The Levites received the tithes of the people, and the priests received the tithes of the Levites, and God was making it possible for them to provide a vital function for the people, this teaching, this oral instruction. This was a major job, if not the major job, of the priests and Levites. And this is one reason why they were so widely scattered and so evenly scattered through the tribes. Nobody in the country, it's kind of like county seats. Our nation is based on the county system of government at the lowest core. And the counties are one thing that has changed very, very little since our government was first established all those years ago. The county was set, the size of the county in general was set so that a man could get on his horse, no matter where he lived in the county, he could get on his horse and get to the county courthouse and get a marriage license for his daughter and make it back home the same night, not have to spend the night away from home. That's why we wound up with counties like we've got back in the old days. And the same thing was true here. Nobody in the land of Israel was more than 10 miles away from one of these Levitical cities. If you had a question about the law, you were within easy reach, an easy walk, of getting over to one of those priests. And there were scores of priests and Levites available as teachers in each of these cities. They could have classes. They could be in constant contact at the grassroots level, teaching the Word of God, precept upon precept, line upon line. Nobody had any reason for ignorance of God's law. During their 2 weeks of service at the central sanctuary, the priests and Levites had the opportunity to read the law and confer with the high priest about difficult issues they faced in their teaching. The revealed law of Moses gave guidance for almost every area of life, but there were occasional questions that were not covered in it. And so there was a special way to get extra information if and when you needed it. This source of information was called Urim and Thummim, and I don't know as much about what it was as I would like to, but these were objects contained in the linen breastplate of the high priest. The exact method by which God gave revelation through the Urim and Thummim is not clear, but they did provide a way through which God's will could be known. A question would be asked, and God would use the Urim and Thummim as a method for giving an answer. And only the high priest was supposed to use the Urim and Thummim. Example, when the Gibeonites came, and they're trying to fake everybody out, they're wearing old raggedy clothes, they just came from over the hill, they're wearing old raggedy clothes, they got moldy bread with them. Oh, we've been on the road so long, we live way off from you, we'll never really be anything for you to be concerned with, so why don't you make a treaty with them? They came asking for a treaty with Israel. The Urim and the Thummim should have been consulted. They were not consulted, and a serious error was made. So you could ask a question and get at least a yes or no answer through Urim and Thummim. So this religious function of the priests and Levites was very, very important. There was very little civil government. The elders had existed since the time of Exodus, and they represented the people in times of discussion. They also disseminated information. They judged when somebody had killed somebody to determine the degree of guilt. They conducted inquests and so forth. Decided cases of controversy on a local level in the gate of the city. But as I said earlier, they probably worked to support themselves, and they only served in public office on a part-time basis. Every community seems to have had its own elders, which suggests that their authority was local only, just like our elders. There's no indication as to how they were appointed or elected to be called elders. Every community had its judges and officers in its local court. Cases that were too hard for the local court were transferred to the Supreme Court, which sat at the central sanctuary and was composed of priests and judges. The judges conducted investigations, and the priests were consultants applying the law and principles from God's law. Decisions required at least two witnesses. If a witness proved false, he was to receive the same punishment that the accused would have received if he was found guilty. Punishment was to be executed without delay, at times by the officials themselves. If the sentence was stoning, then the witnesses were to cast the first stone. Elders and court officials were the extent of civil personnel for maintaining social order. Elders and court personnel did not make law. They did not enforce laws, really. They just decided cases. And this still allowed God to be the king. The prophets were here too, but they were not a part of the government. They were just the recipients of God's revelation. That's their one place of recognition in the law, in Deuteronomy 18, that they would get revelations from God. So they were the conveyors of messengers given by God. God gave information through Urim and Thummim, but that was mainly yes or no answers to questions, and very little other information, if any. But the prophets, by contrast to the Urim and Thummim, you could use the Urim and Thummim. The high priest could use the Urim and Thummim anytime he thought it was time to do so. But the prophets had to wait for a revelation from God. But when God did speak, the information was a fuller, more complete message than was given by Urim and Thummim. So the message of the prophets and the information from Urim and Thummim each had their place. Prophets during the period of the judges probably were never very numerous. Deborah was a prophetess. There was an unnamed prophet in the time of Gideon. Samuel was a prophet. But there weren't very many. Samuel was the first national prophet. There were other prophets during his time. The main point here is that civil government was kept at an absolute minimum. No earthly nation has ever had a beginning which promised anything as wonderful as what God had designed for Israel. Now, I was asking my assignment to say a bit about the enemies of the Israelite during the era of the judges, and I want to do that quickly. The first enemy was the Mesopotamians in chapter 3, verse 8. This particular tribe of Mesopotamians was probably the people known as the Abiru, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that are known archaeologically. These were semi-nomadic wanderers who frequently lived by pillaging. Some of them became mercenary soldiers for other people. Some of them sold themselves into slavery. They came to southern Canaan to make conquest as they could. They left the Israelites alone at first because the Canaanites were in the more attractive lowlands, having not been driven out by the Israelites, and so the Mesopotamians were the enemies of the Canaanites as well as the enemies of the Israelites. Israel was still confined to the hill country as a result of not having destroyed the native population. But the Mesopotamians were the first one. This is the tribe in archaeology that's probably referred to by the term Mesopotamians. This on the board here is a more specific expression than Mesopotamians. All Habiru were Mesopotamians, but not all Mesopotamians were Habiru. Number two enemy, the Ammonites. These were obviously descendants of Lot. They lived over in Transjordan, across the Jordan River. After the Edomites had caused the children of Israel to walk about 180 extra miles, that they wouldn't have needed to walk because they couldn't go through the Edomite land, the Moabites also refused to let the children of Israel pass. And from that time on, there was tremendous animosity between them, the Moabites, and the Israelites. Later, the Moabites were among those who hired Balaam to curse the Israelites. God said neither an Ammonite nor a Moabite should enter into the congregation of Jehovah to the 10th generation. Enemy number three, the Canaanites. should have been entirely destroyed by Israel at the time of the conquest, but weren't. Hazor, which was Jabin's capital, has been well identified, 9 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. There's an oval-shaped tell of about 25 acres, and a much larger plateau next to it of about 175 acres, for a total of 200 acres for this site of Hazor, indicating that Hazor was the largest city of ancient Palestine. Excavation of the site of Hazor began in 1955 under Yagiel Yadin. As many as 200 laborers and 45 technicians worked on this project for quite some period of time, and this site of 200 total acres compares with Lachish at 18 acres, Megiddo at 14 acres, and Jericho at just 8 acres. So you can see how huge Hazor was. Now Joshua earlier had burned Hazor with fire. It was completely destroyed 170 years before the time it becomes relevant in Judges chapter 4. But it had recovered in large part by the time of Deborah. The king in both Joshua's day and in Deborah's day is named Jabin, which makes us think that maybe it was a family name passed down. Go ahead, Tom. Yeah, I was going to cover them last because although the Philistines are there in the time of Shamgar, but it was just a few of them. There were two main migrations of the Philistines to the Promised Land. They came from the Aegean Sea area, the island of Crete, and then there. A few of them came early and were there for Shamgar's time. Sir Flinders Petrie thought that the reason they were there early was to export grain back to Crete and the other places that they came from to keep the people going there. So the main mass of them were not yet in the Promised Land in the time of Shamgar. Shamgar killed 600 of them with his ox goad, but they don't seem to be a major military oppressor yet at that time. That's why I didn't list Shamgar for sure as a military deliverer. He may have been, but all we know for sure about him is that there's one verse, that he killed 600 Philistines with his ox goad. And whether he did this all at once, which I kind of doubt, I think he may have done it over a period of time. But just what was going on there, we're left to guess about. But the main migration of the Sea Peoples, and Sea Peoples is an expression that comes from Egyptian sources. The Sea Peoples, including the Philistines, came at a later period of time, and then they became the real oppressors of God's people and the most severe. Excellent question. Thank you. Other questions or thoughts? Yeah, Chance? Oh, the Moabites? Yeah. Yes. Number one, the Mesopotamians. Number two, the Moabites. Number three, the Canaanites. Number four, the Midianites. Descended from Abraham by Keturah, Genesis 25. Zipporah, the wife of Moses, was the daughter of a Midianite whose name was Jethro or Reuel. Apparently, it's another name applied to the same man. After this fourth oppression in the book of Judges, we don't read about the Midianites in the Bible anymore. They may have ceased to be a separate tribal group. I think that's probably what happened. They were amalgamated by others. Probably the Ishmaelites. Remember, even in the Genesis story of Joseph, in Genesis 37, sometimes they're the Midianites, sometimes they're the Ishmaelites. I used to puzzle over that. Which one is it? Well, I think what was happening is, even in that early time, they're amalgamating together with one another. And in the Gideon story, after they've been called Midianites all the way through the story, they're referred to Ishmaelites at the end of the story in Judges 8:24. So they're Midianites, but yet they're Ishmaelites. And I don't think that needs to trouble us. It's just mixing and amalgamating of people. People have legs. They're always moving from one place to another. And when we try to separate them from each other to specify and talk about them, it's sometimes easier said than done. They may also have amalgamated with the Medanites, descended from Medan, M-E-D-A-N. He was a full brother of Midian, son of Abraham.